Season 3 of the Missing Witches podcast is brought to you by Foxglove Farm. Use offer code MISSINGWITCHES at checkout.
Welcome to Season 3 of Witches Found, the companion series to the Missing Witches podcast, where we interview contemporary witches to make sure they never go missing.
You spoke to a forensic anthropologist.
Can you believe that? I was writing an episode about a witch archaeologist, and then a witch archaeologist slid into our DMs and came to my house. Came to my house. So thank you so much, Vanessa. Here's my interview with her where we talk about life, death, burial, art, pretty much everything on the spectrum of existence. Please enjoy this conversation with archaeologist and witch, Vanessa.
You aren't being a proper woman, therefore you must be a witch. You must be a witch.
So this interview, everybody, is super magical, and I'm going to tell you why. I had just started writing the Maria Gimbutas episode, which y'all just heard a couple few days ago, and so I was just getting into this witch archaeologist, and maybe a week after I started writing this episode, Missing Witches got a message from a witch archaeologist, who of course did not know that I was writing this because I had said nothing to anyone, and showed up in our DMs ready to talk to me about the intersection of witchcraft and archaeology. And not only this, but she is currently in my house. So get this, everybody. I started writing this episode about a witch archaeologist, and then a witch archaeologist slid into my DMs and drove to my house. Y'all, if that is not magic, I do not know what is. So let me introduce to you the witch archaeologist and many other things that we will get into, Vanessa.
Hi.
So first of all, what do you want Missing Witches listeners to know about you right off the top? What's your...
Well, I can say that the most interesting part, the reason that I connected with you and that I actually wrote to you is because of the Missing Witches Times or X podcast that you did with Pam Grossman about her book.
Yes.
And then when I heard about you guys, because I hadn't heard of you guys before, I looked at your other episodes and then I saw Witches in Labs, and that totally blew my mind because I felt so seen even before I actually listened to the episode. And then when I did, I was just amazed because it's really rare to find both the science part of my personality and the witch part of my personality, and I to actually hear people talk about witchcraft and magic in that way. So it really made me so happy, and that's why I wrote to you, because I don't know if you remember, but my message was only exclamation points, and I was like, can't believe this is happening, because I call myself a science witch. So to actually listen to that episode and to see that I'm not the only one was just incredible. So that's what I want you to know about me, that I come from a very scientific binary background into a very artistic and non-binary open background.
I am so freaking happy that you just said this, because in the writing, for those of you who are listening, we're recording this in August. You're listening to it in September. So I'm still working on this Maria Gimbutas episode. But I wrote a section because she found these androgynous figures that had both quote masculine, quote feminine properties, that in the episode I actually get into the binary and what is the binary and what does that mean. So tell me about that from your scientific witch perspective. Can you tell us about the binary?
Sure. Actually, this is really interesting because this is where also the part of me that is a mother comes into play, because my daughter is teaching me so much about being non-binary. But in general, in archaeology and other human sciences, we are still catching up to this whole idea of non-binary world, because binary is how we understood it. So male, female, you know, even with the first internet, it was like 11001. That's totally binary code, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was always man the hunter and woman the gatherer. And that's how we sort of understood humanity and the evolution of humanity. So even for me, when my daughter would be like, why do we need to have gender? I was like, oh my God, I can only give you my very binary archaeologist point of view, which feels old now, which feels encrusted in this kind of like way of imagining things. So because humans have male, female, and that's how we understand evolution and how we got to where we are now. I think archaeology has lots of catching up to do. And I think that the fact that women are now more and more teaching and part of the higher echelons, let's say, of university and university projects and also non-university projects, that's going to bring a lot more of a non-binary feel or a more open way of interpreting things. But the binary is a very old school way of understanding human evolution.
Yes. And my understanding of it comes from, or my academic understanding of it comes from my lit degree. So in literary criticism, it's the same thing. But, you know, people came along to break all of that down and say, you know, when we create these binaries, we're implicitly creating hierarchies. If you put things on one side or two sides, ultimately one is good and one is bad. One is going to be aligned with one side.
Right away.
With the other.
And it's really interesting because you have very ancient cultures that had like a multiplicity of genders, for example, if you want to talk just about the gender issue. And so they never had just one or the other. There was always a bigger spectrum of these possibilities. But then the researchers who were actually studying them were, you know, white men for the most part in the past. And so would hide some of the evidence or just like literally find a way of interpreting it so that it's not reflective of what that culture really had.
You mentioned something to me in our online dialogue about the assessment of the pelvic bones. Yes. And there is always something that was just like, well, it's this, so it's that. What was that again?
Okay, so I am I specialize in human remains, so I was
also
digging.
Very witchy. Can just
totally
say, yeah.
So osteology or physical anthropology, there's many words to describe what I do, what I did. And so my thesis advisor was an older gentleman. He was a mentor and he was very important in the first part of my career. But every single time we would find the remains of a woman who was between 25 and 40 years old, he would always say she must have died while giving birth because her pelvis is too small. And so,
which is, of course, the only way a woman can possibly die.
Of course.
Between the ages of like 20
age,
and
yeah,
40,
that's right.
Or 15 and 40, right.
And so it just shows that there's a problem there, because what we see are the remains, right? So we don't see any of the flesh or anything like that. And, you know, as we, some of us who have had kids, we know that, you know, the body expands so that the baby's head can go through. And yes, there was a lot of infant mortality. It happened a lot that women would die in childbirth. But then to like always bring up this one cause of death, which is something we don't really do. I remember thinking, really, like, do you really know how the human female body works that you would say this like that? So I think you can apply that to other fields and other interpretations, like you know, man the hunter and woman the gatherer, and now we can have a more nuanced dialogue about these things.
Yes, long time coming, but we're bursting through,
right? Slowly but surely.
How did you get interested in archaeology? Like, what was your moment?
I guess I always, just like me being a witch, I always knew. I kind of always knew. And when I was studying at university, I was at Concordia and I was studying in fine arts. I was doing a bachelor, but then as an elective, I took anthropology 101. And then I was like, okay, no, this is what I should be doing. And I'm changing right now. Like, I didn't even finish my bachelor. I had 6 months left. I'm like, nope. start all over
again. Why waste the time? I exactly. know what I'm doing. Right.
So
right.
so then I went into archaeology at Université de Montréal, and then I knew that that was where I was meant to be for sure. And I ended up meeting this man, and he was working on human remains, which was kind of like new at that time because there was still the idea of leaving the remains where they are and them being kind of like a sacrilege to sort of dig them up. But as you know, because you live in a village, mm-hmm. of a smaller rural community, around the old church, usually there's a cemetery. Mm-hmm. And Hydro-Québec at that time had a program where they would bury the electrical wires to, you know, make it pretty. And mm-hmm. inevitably, they would go through the cemetery. So a big part of my career was helping to dig up the bones that were in those cemeteries. But the very first human remains that I ever saw, it was in Odanak, which is just outside of Trois-Rivières, and it was on an indigenous land. Mm-hmm. And it was on the side of a sand pit, and people were taking sands for their foundations of their houses, and bones were trickling down. Mm-hmm. So because now indigenous people would rather we leave their bones alone, and as it should be, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They did ask us to come in and just remove those two burials so that they could be reburied somewhere safer.
To protect them, exactly. Not to exploit them.
Totally. Mm-hmm. And so we were just going in for those two interventions. And then when we ended up uncovering the first one, it just like pierced my heart. It was the first time I saw human remains. It was my first time on a dig of that kind. And it was a woman, and she was lying on her side in a fetal position with her hands over her head. It was so moving. I have chills. Yeah. And so when I saw that, I thought, I'm so responsible right now for this woman because people put her that way. She wasn't buried, like she didn't fall or die in that position. Somebody made sure she would be okay for her afterlife by being placed in this manner. So that really struck a chord in me. And that's how I really decided to focus on this throughout my career. At the beginning, I was very involved in how grief is manifested and how you have to, you know, take care of your dead and follow a certain program, like in quotation marks, mm-hmm. to make sure that, you know, they get where they're supposed to go in the afterlife. So whether you believe in that or not, the families of these people did believe that. And so that was always what super interested me in working with human remains.
So as a witch and as an archaeologist, you must have a lot of thoughts about death.
Yes.
And I don't want to bum anybody out, but, you know, we witches, we mostly think of death as a next transition. You know, it's not an end. I like to use the metaphor of a candle being blown out. You know, you blow out a candle and the flame goes away, but there's that wisp of smoke that just sort of goes into the air and then becomes everything.
Yes.
You know, and that's sort of my thinking about it. You become something else and everything all at once. And
yes.
So, but tell me, as a scientist, as a witch, and as a mother, what do you think about death?
So for me, death is a passage. And I have always felt, as an archaeologist, that I was super privileged to see what remains after and the physical manifestation of grief and of love. And, you know, obviously there used to be family feuds back then too. We don't see those. But to see what is included in some of the burials, and to see how people were placed and the importance that others put in making sure the body was disposed of as it should be so that the soul or whatever you want to call it goes where it's supposed to go. So that part of death for me is fascinating. And like I said, I have a very sort of motherly and a very emotional attachment to my work. So I remember my favorite part was with when you're around the skull or the face with just a our paintbrushes, you know, or our popsicle sticks, mm-hmm. you could all of a sudden uncover all the teeth, and then you would have the smile. You would have, you know, the actual person, and you could feel there was something there. These were turn of the century, you know, 18th century, late 18th century burials, often in Catholic cemeteries or Protestant cemeteries. So sometimes we would find beads, crucifixes, but then with the children's burial, you would find dolls or you would find little messages. And then as you get closer to our time, you would find, you know, plaques with the name of the person or just sayings like au repos or au sommeil, en paix, things like that. So all of that was very moving to me. So even though I'm trained to also look at the biological aspect of the skeleton, which is also a really something that I love, what interested me is where these two things intersect. So grief and death and that passage, how to make sure that passage happens how it should be, and then the actual bones themselves and what they have to tell me about that person's life. Because even though it's just the bones, and even though we're all the same, because we all have a skeleton with the same number of bones and types of bones, mm-hmm. each of them tell a story. And so that was the second part of my job that I loved, is that when you go into the laboratory, there's a very ritualistic thing that happens where we wash the bones. Mm. We wash the remains, and that's your first chance. If you look at it with just your scientist hat, you're just, you know, it's your first glimpse at what is going on in the skeleton and identifying if it's a male or female, for example. But then if you're wearing your witch hat, then you can really start to get familiar, and you realize that you are responsible for these bones and you are taking them out of the context where they were placed, because that person needed to go through the passage to go where they're supposed to go. And you are allowed to see them. You're allowed to analyze them. And then after, they will go and be reburied somewhere else. So you have a privileged access to what those bones can say to you. So that was, for me, the most important part of my work, is like, what are they going to tell me?
And what do they tell you?
So many things about sickness, health. Yes. I mean, in the TV shows, it's all about cause of death, but mm-hmm. in reality, in a cemetery setting, it's not that, because very rarely do les maladies, so sickness will take a long time to get to the bone. So they'll get to the, you know, les tissus before they get there.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry for my...
No, they get to the tissues, yeah, the before tissues, they get to you. The bone, yeah.
And so you can know a person's age of death. You can also know, obviously, male or female, except when they're children, the different markers of gender are not so obvious, or I should say biological sex are not so obvious yet. Mm-hmm. And then you can see if they're in relative health or not. Some long-term chronic diseases or deficiencies will show up in the bones in different areas. So some of the things I've seen is I have seen cancer show up. Metastasized cancer is particularly unpleasant to look at. Arthritis is very common, and lots of times in the spine. You can see old injuries. When I worked at the Museum of History in Hull, in Ottawa, Gatineau, there was the skull of a woman who had been killed by a polar bear. And so she had all these wounds in her skull. So you can sometimes know what the person died of, but mostly what you see is how they lived their life. Were they healthy? Did they have access to good food? If they had caries or problems with their teeth, you can see that also.
And how is that witchcraft?
Well, that part is not so much the witchcraft to me. That's really the science part. But the witchcraft part is the whole ritual that goes around it. And at the time, I wasn't thinking it was witchcraft. Mm-hmm. Only later on did I see this. But the whole immersive atmosphere for me was always one of reverence. Whether it's on the dig, even though there's like, you know, the backhoe making noise, because it's like, and it's usually a construction site, and then you're surrounded by men, and you're this woman here, and you're telling them what to do and to get away and give you space to do your work. Then all of that sort of fades into the background, and you're what, you know, you're there with the remains themselves, and you are taking, literally taking them out of the earth, out of that context. And so that's where the ritual comes in for me. And as I said, in the lab with the, that, you know, measuring the bones, it's always very specific. So it's scientific, because you have to be able to take measurements that are the same across the board. Otherwise you can't compare your samples, things like that. But each one is going to tell you something different. So that's where the magic is for me, literally.
So what do you want done with your body when you die?
Oh, yes. So
as the expert, maybe you can give us some tips on making our own plans.
I mean, there's so many options now that are so interesting, like aquamation is all new. But I really like the idea of being buried somewhere. And I'm super old school, where I'm like, oh, I'd like to be buried and, you know, have a, maybe a message or a plaque or something really, really nice with me. But, recently, well, I mean, I left the church. I'm an apostate, so I cannot be buried in a cemetery. So now that's like a whole new, realm of possibilities. So I really like the idea of a green burial. Or if not, I'd just like be in the ocean. Like that's what we did with my father's ashes. And that was so beautiful. I thought that was a beautiful ceremony. So I think I could like, you know, being all over the world in the water, that sounds nice to me. So
and I know one of my personal beliefs is that, you know, the ocean is our great mother. We came from her, you know, this is the womb that humanity came from. So return to that place.
Every time I go next to the ocean, I get a gift, you know, from my father. I imagine it to be from my father, but I always get something very specific. And I really like that whole idea. And if you know, it goes with my notion that it's a passage. And so death is a passage. Therefore, you're still here in another form.
Mm-hmm. And I like to think about those people that were buried becoming soil. Yeah. The idea of becoming soil is like the ultimate reincarnation. Like soil is like everything. It's like, I don't even know what else to say.
It's
like
amazing.
Becoming soil is like... You know?
There is something beautiful about that. And when you are actually doing the dig, you know, there's so much that goes into play. For example, the pH balance in the soil will affect the bones in a different manner, and the different types of bones as well. And so sometimes you will have no trace of the coffin, but the bones will be fine. Or sometimes it's the opposite. The coffin is there, but it's empty because the bones have all disappeared, depending on the chemistry of the soil itself. But, you know, this whole idea of burial and the whole idea of what happens after you die and sort of getting to a solace, right? To getting to a place where serenity is part of this whole concept. So my last contract before we left for China, I worked for the National Defense of Canada at the Heritage and History Division, and I worked with identifying Canada's soldiers that died in the Second or First World Wars.
What a noble project.
It was the most moving part of my career. I had never ever felt the emotions that I felt while I worked there. And we had a project where we found, and I organized an excavation to go get a soldier who was found in a Brussels sprouts field in Belgium. And so this was my first time putting a name to someone, which is very, very confronting, because for me it was just male, female, mm-hmm. you know, age group, and you know, cause of death or any other things that the bones were telling me, but it was never a name. And so looking at the eight candidates, you know, this one liked to play hockey, and that one, you know, was married, and is very, very moving, you know, on top of the fact that they died in a battle during the Second World War. So that was pretty intense. So that dig was also my first one, not in a cemetery, in a burial context. So we knew that he died, you know, in this battle. So probably from a gunshot wound. And when we found him, when we did find him, he was sitting down. And I remember picking up his boot, which was laced, and his foot bones were in it. But I was like, 72 years ago, he tied that lace. He tied that boot, and now I'm picking it up. And so I got that same very deep emotional connection that I'm responsible for this man. And he happened to have a wedding ring. And I took the phalange out of the wedding ring, and his initials were on it. So we were able to identify him very quickly. If you go look on the website, you can see all about this man. But what it gave me was this extra amazing feeling that now he has a name again. He has his name again, and he can be reburied. So when we contacted his family, which was amazing because his family was still remembered him. Mm-hmm. And so they got to choose what to write on his tombstone. And they said, "You were lost and now you are found, and we rejoice." Oh. It was so beautiful. So Private Donaldson, like, if you, I'll send you the link.
Yeah, and we'll put it in the show notes.
It was just so moving and so fantastic. So that was definitely a highlight. And I remember being in the lab and then washing his bones and knowing that his name was Duncanson. Sorry, not Donaldson. And so the men who had worked with us in Belgium were like, "Oh, he's a hero. He's a Canadian hero. He fought, you know, he fought for us." And I remember just being blown away by that whole process. Yeah, so that was a very big highlight.
Yeah, we see this so often with people who do amazing things and then are lost and then are found. And people that, you know, it came up in Zora Neale Hurston, you know, and like, and it's funny too, because when Alice Walker went looking for the story of Zora Neale Hurston, she called it gathering bones. To go and search for ancestor histories is to be gathering these bones.
Of course.
And that's literally what you're doing and giving. And we know, again, as witches, the importance of naming what we name ourselves or what we name our tools and how much power that words have.
Absolutely.
And then on plus to return him to his family in a, like,
yes,
this is the ultimate. I can't imagine the glory.
It's like closure, right? It's like finally and he was reburied to the day 72 years after his death. So September 14th, and it was in 2017 that he was reburied. Canada doesn't repatriate the remains of the soldiers that are found. They are buried with their brothers in arms in the cemetery close to where they fell. So he was reburied in Belgium. But it was just like the family, the next of kin are flown out. And it's a very beautiful ceremony. And soldiers really do take that part of the ritual seriously. And it's beautiful what they do. So they really bring a sense of ceremony and like solemnity to it. And they give him a proper burial, and which they did, you know, 72 years to the day later. So it was a really beautiful, beautiful, for me, it was kind of like a goodbye to that part of my career, because after that we were posted to Beijing and then started my second career, can say it that way, which is an artist. So it took me a long time to be able to say that word, because I really identified as an archaeologist for so long, and rightly so. But we had a first posting in Hong Kong for 4 years, and my children were very young. And I remember feeling so, so lost, because some people can be full-time mothers and I cannot. So it was really hard for me to just find myself in this new part of the world, which was quite exciting, but then not being able to really enjoy it fully, because I was taking care of my kids, right? And so I had to find something else to helped me be more than only a mother, because for me that was very difficult. And so I went back, like, I've always been an artist also. And so it was just like, helped me to get back to that and to sort of put my emotions down on paper. I work in art journals. So basically it was, to save me from having to do therapy. So, I really went back to that side of my personality, which is creative and which is also totally witchcraft, even though that took me a while to realize that that's what I was doing. But basically I was doing spell work, trying to put down emotions onto paper and to transform something into something else.
Yeah, we stand by that 100%.
Yeah, for sure.
Any act of creation or destruction can be witchcraft if your yes. intentions are clear enough.
Exactly. Yes, and so that's why, like, the notion of art witch came along. So I am both science witch, but I'm also the art witch, and that just seems so obvious to me once we thought about it. And mm-hmm. I was talking to it with two other friends, and we're like, yeah, of course, because you don't even have to be that intentional about it, but like, there is a reverence that comes when you pull out your tools and you think about how you're going to create something out of nothing or transform one thing into something else. And so most of my art is not about the end result, but about the process. So that's where the ritual comes in, and the whole idea of alchemy mm-hmm. even comes in. And that's how I equate it with witchcraft.
So before we dive into your Art Witch Academy, which we obviously absolutely will, we talked about how you became an archaeologist, but we never really talked about how you became a witch.
Oh, that's
Do you have a moment, or was it like one of those, you know, Risa and I talk all the time about, like, right. there was no moment, right. it just kind of always was.
I think there was a moment for me of not necessarily being a witch, but of rejecting the very patriarchal Catholic elements of my upbringing was not very religious. My parents were not very religious, but I did go to Catholic school. Mm-hmm. And so all of that was like just so heavy all the time, and I didn't like it. And I remember actively seeking out something like I would say religion. So I was like, looked into Wicca for a while because I wanted something with a strong female aspect to it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I was interested in goddesses and all of that stuff. But as soon as it had any dogma in it, I rejected it. Totally. So Wicca for me didn't do it, because it was all like, put your tools here and then go, you know, the four corners and the directions. And I was like, that's not how it feels right for me. Yes. So, which is kind of funny, because, you know, that's what I like about looking at the burials, that people are following these prescriptions mm-hmm. about how to bury their dead. But like, I reject it for myself.
Yeah.
So
I think because you know how much you can learn, so you want to put yourself into it instead
yeah.
of.
Yes. I love that idea of it being a practice, yes. and not a religion.
Yes.
So for me, that's the most important part of it. So the idea of it comes from you. And that's also how I use tarot. Like, I don't use it as a predictive tool or fortune telling tool. Sometimes I do, but yeah, I think we all do that.
Divination, of course.
Yeah, that's right. For the wheel of the year part.
Yeah.
But you know, mostly it's all about how it comes from you. So that's always been my way of seeing things, is that you're a big part. You have free will. You're very much a participant in your life. And that's what magic is for me. So, you know, the idea of witchcraft is just flowing from that. So I love the idea of the witch, because I like reclaiming that word. I really think that's important. And I really think that there is power in saying it. And it did take me a while because of the science part of me, which was so like, this has to be scientific. You have to be able to prove it. But I remember having all of these discussions with my advisors, because they were like, this is too emotional. You can't be just talking about it in these terms. You need to bring it back to it's human sciences. But I'm like, yes, but it's human. So there's also
sciences,
that.
Yeah.
And so I guess in a while it just like, it stopped being only science for me. And then that's why I was able to develop this whole side of the more artistic side and the more emotional side of that part mm-hmm. of me.
I mean, which we, of course, talk about all the time. Like, for us, there's no argument, yes. you know, as the white feathers, which which is, say, you know, they say like methodology is just ritual. Like they have prophecies, not hypotheses, things like that. It's the same idea.
Love that.
And again, like, you know, witchcraft is... I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, whatever, witches were the first scientists,
mm-hmm.
you know, yes. because they were the ones who were, you know, experimenting.
Absolutely.
You know,
experimentation is a big part of science for sure. And there is a need for, you know, I'm not saying that it's bad to have, things that can be replicated and redone, right? You need to have a certain number of parameters that are useful, because otherwise you can't, you know, make the experiment work, because you can't prove that it worked the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that need for that very rigid methodology type thing. But there is also space for this other part of it as well.
Yeah. And only then can we get like a whole picture, I think, of this yeah. human experience, right? Yeah. When we blend those things.
And I feel like women can do that a bit more, you know, women with an X. And
Wimex.
Yeah, Wimex. Okay. So this is another thing that we can say about the binary, is that in the French language, it's really difficult
mm-hmm.
because we don't have the it. So we only have he or she.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes when I speak in English, I have trouble using the right terms, because in French it's so either or.
Yeah. But right? It's also, it's like, it's non-patriarchal in the sense that it's a bit more random. Like le féminisme, yes. la masculinité is
know,
my favorite
so
example.
True.
Feminism is masculine and masculinity is feminine.
It's so true.
In the French language, you know, it's like...
You're so confusing.
The verbs are gendered, but like, not like you'd think.
Yeah, yeah. Just to make it really, really tough. But...
Just to make it impossible. And that's how I always get clocked. But yeah. of not being a native French speaker
uh-huh.
is that I mess up my lows and lows all the time, because it's not like, it's one of those things, it's like you either have it or you
yeah, absolutely you absolutely yeah. why is there that, does the table have a gender?
Yeah.
I mean
yeah.
There's no logic to it.
I will say this, because we've never really had a chance to talk about this on the podcast before, but I think that there is a different mindset in French, and I think part of it has to do with the language, and maybe you'll help me unpack this right now for like 2 minutes, where like in English I am hungry.
Yes.
I am 41 years old.
Yes.
But in French, I have hunger.
Yes.
It doesn't define me.
Nope.
J'ai faim.
Yeah.
You know, I have 41 years.
Yes.
It's not what I am.
Absolutely.
It's something that I have. So as someone who is more natively French than me,
yeah.
can you like dive into that a little bit?
I just love that, because it's like the idea of temporality. Something being temporary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Temporality. So basically, yeah, that it's the state you are in right now, but you will not forever be in there.
Yeah.
There's that in Spanish also, because they have two words for be, the verb be, to be. They have two different ones, and one of them is more permanent and one of them is for, you know, punctual things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I love that.
We don't really have that in English
no.
at all.
No.
You're this, and it almost
forever.
Is that, like, again, here we are in that like forced binary of you are this or that.
True.
There's no this and that.
True.
It's this or that. I am hungry.
But it's so interesting, because it limits how you can express these new ideas, because you only have he or she in French. So it's very interesting to navigate that. So I'm interested in seeing how also that trickles down to the sciences.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a scientist and myself as like a student of literature and arts,
yeah.
like we are so grateful for the old guard and for the paths that
oh,
they
sure.
did carve. But, you know, we're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater, as they say. But like these ideas need to be unpacked.
Yeah.
We need to talk about these things from a contemporary perspective
yes.
without, you know, demonizing the people who did this, you know, usually well-intentioned work. Sometimes, like you said, it's like men hiding bones that didn't agree
yeah.
with their hypothesis.
Yes.
But, you know, let's hope.
And
that.
Now, well, some of those things are being now not fixed, but addressed. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I did my master's on culture, the Mache culture in Peru, and they're renowned for their ceramics, and they have a whole bunch of erotic ceramics. Mm-hmm. So, you know, collectioners and people would like rob the burials because, you know, they would go grave digging to try and find some of these pots because they were so beautiful. And collectioners, you know, would be like, woohoo, erotic pottery. That's so exciting. but there are examples of homosexuality. And so when it's the two women, it was fine. But when it was the two men, there was like all of these. Well, first of all, you couldn't find them. Or
can you hear me audibly sighing, listeners?
Or the men were explained like a power structure. Oh, it's a metaphor for the power structure, which is often. So it also goes back to primatology, where they study primates, right, mm-hmm. as a sort of indicator of the first humans, or a way of explaining how we act as humans, you know, with the caveat that we have free will and choice and all that stuff. But you will find homosexuality among the females, and it's, of course, a power structure thing. And so, well, now it's changing. And obviously these pots are resurfacing, the ones that can be, you know, bought back from collectors and taken out of vaults because they were hidden, because they go against the interpretation that these men were giving of this culture. Right? And so now more and more we're getting a more nuanced mm-hmm. sort of, and, you know, the Mache were really awesome. They had dwarves, and they would paint, with their ceramics, they would make actual, really perfect representations of different illnesses. So it was possible to find out if people had leprosy, you know, what was present in the pre-Columbian world before. So it was very, very interesting. And so it's good that this is now being reintegrated to the knowledge that we have of, and this is just one particular culture. So imagine that, you know, across the world.
Yeah. I so much is coming out, that I don't know if it's been intentionally, you know, misplaced this information, but about these like quote unquote savage cultures or prehistoric, where obvious, and then it's actually like, no, they had these systems and they were doing this kind of navigation and they were doing. So what can we learn from that which is ancient?
I think we can learn to be open and just, I feel like patriarchy's legacy is to funnel things down and to really have this very strong power structure and this whole idea of, I feel like it's often related to the brain only, mm-hmm. you know, you have to master your emotions, you have to be clean, you have to be white, mm-hmm. So that you can have access to whatever you want later, mm-hmm. you know, when you die. And I feel like more ancient civilizations and, religions also were more about the earth and being grounded and being dirty and laughing too loud and dancing and expressing your joy instead of being white and dry and just ascending.
Clean,
you know?
And
yes.
And ascending, yeah.
Instead of, I think they were more like descending and be here now. Mm-hmm. It was not about the after, it was about the now and then the passage.
Yes.
You know, so that's what I feel is that it's réducteur a lot of the times. So now we can realize, well, it's not just binary. It's not just man, female. It was also, well, you know, third sex, fourth sex or gender. That was a French expression, the deuxième sexe.
Yeah. Right. Shout out Simone de Beauvoir.
Yeah, thank you. And so I think we can learn from that for sure, about the horizon or the spectrum being way larger than we would, than, you know, the patriarchy or patriarchal interpretation of it would like us to think.
Mm-hmm. And I've certainly seen this a lot. And I spoke to the witches in the lab about this, that you get this condescension when you say anything that's not science-based or knowledge-based. But I like to use the metaphor of, like, slavery, for example. Let's go big,
that's
right?
That's quite a metaphor.
Here we go. We're going. This is Missing Witches. Let's go. Because, like, logically, of course, it makes the most sense to take people and not pay them.
Yep.
Scientifically, this is how you get the most profit for your whatever you're doing.
Yep.
Only when you bring emotion into the argument does somebody say, this feels wrong. Hurting people feels wrong. So, I mean, to all those people that probably aren't listening to this podcast, because why would you be, but who feel that there's no room for nonsense, and I mean nonsense as in that which does not necessarily make sense,
right.
For emotion, for our feelings to be a valid.
Yeah, that's exactly
period,
it.
Period, you know.
So when did that become something to take out of the equation?
Yeah.
You know, we say hard science, and there is a space for that, for sure. But I really like this idea of bringing in some emotions and not being judged for that. That part of it, because it is human sciences. And of course, I have right now feelings of like a little bit of stress at my colleagues who are going to listen to this and be like, what the hell? You know, that's not part of it. But I think that anyone who knows me knows this about me, that was the link between these two things, mm-hmm. between hard sciences and humans. And studying humans, it's called anthropology. You're studying humans. So obviously you cannot separate that, mm-hmm. in my view. But if you're trying to please a power structure that's been there for a long time, and it has to be dry, and it has to be clean, and it has to be replicable, mm-hmm. Then obviously you have to take the emotion out of it. But that, to me, was... like, I didn't understand why, because I really like having the emotion in there, and I think it belongs there, especially when you're talking about dead humans.
Mm-hmm. And Gim Butes, this was like her whole thing. And,
of
you
course.
Know, listeners, you've already heard this episode. I hope if you haven't, please go check out the Maria Gim Butes episode from a couple few days ago. Because I've seen her called like laughing stock, you know, all
right.
of this thing, because she insisted on bringing, for one reason anyway, she insisted on bringing her emotional intelligence
yes.
into her work.
Yes.
So do you know anything about that? Can you get into it from a more...
Well,
I'm coming at it from like a journalistic
right.
standpoint. So.
But well, I think that's obviously the, you know, the established people, like, the one thing about archaeology is that we are not working in absolutes. Because tomorrow there's a new technology that can come out and be like, well, here, now we know, we just have to like take this sample and no need to go look for DNA and, you know, go down the matriarchal line to find the descendants. So basically the idea is that because of the way the power structure is set up, then you have to, you know, people get grants, people get money to further their studies. So obviously if it looks... woo woo, mm-hmm. to use that term, to plug mm-hmm. that in there. It's like it's not serious. It's seen as not serious. But so something happened at some point where, in my mind, it's a male dominated thing
yeah.
where we need to like separate from our emotions and be super cerebral instead of being with the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, that's where it's a mistake. And the mistake is also looking down on somebody who wants to bring the heart in, because these are humans. And so obviously there's the heart, there's emotion. In any culture in the world, there is so much of the blending of these two things. So how can you separate them when you're studying them? And why or when did it become not scientific to add emotion or to add that? It's the human element in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I feel like things are changing. I've been out of the university context for a while now.
Same. Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that it's changing and that there's a whole new generation of people. But like, there's been, you know, it's slow. And archaeologists, you know, we take our time.
Thousands
we like
and thousands
old things.
Of years sometimes.
you know, I was looking at some of the... like conferences, like the annual conferences. And then there's the whole... Me Too movement now that is coming up in archaeology as well, because you have, you know, field work, and oftentimes it's few women with, you know, it was a male dominated, although I've never had any of those kinds of issues. You do have to find your space in a male context. So as much the construction workers who are paid 5 times more than you, but look down on you because you're slowing down their project, mm-hmm. as your advisor, who's like, oh, clearly she died because her pelvis is too small. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, well, I don't think so. Well, you're too emotional anyway. Yeah. So, you know, I've had those comments. But I think that now more and more it's changing. And in Quebec, we're pretty good for that. A lot of the Me Too movements that I've seen in relation to archaeology has been in the States. But some things are unacceptable. And these are, you know, long established professors. Mm-hmm. And so those structures need to fall also.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think we're seeing that. Luckily, yep. You and I are about the same age. Yep. So we sort of came through in a bit. It was like changing.
Yes.
You know, the vocabulary absolutely. Was definitely changing when I was doing my degree. But I think people who get hung up on facts are fooling themselves anyway, you know, like. Even if you're reading a scientific paper, you're reading the scientist's opinion of what was important to include in this paper.
Exactly.
And what was not necessary to include. And again, this in and of itself is an opinion. And yes. This is how we see these very skewed takes. Right?
Right. Which is a given in archaeology, and I think a lot of other ones as well, other disciplines, but I can only speak about my own. But at some point, it's like they forget that. Once they get, you know, their professors and they're established and people read their articles, they forget that they don't have the final interpretation and that somebody else can come along and should. Mm-hmm. Come along and have a new interpretation. You know, in the 60s, there was this big movement called the New Archaeology, which like really, you know, and there's so many kinds of archaeology. There's political archaeology. There's, you know, archaeology that's really stuck on material culture only. You have religious, political, all of the different theories to understand humanity, including Marxism, Lenin, like all of that finds itself in archaeological interpretations. So really now it's okay to add in the heart and add in the emotion because we're there. I feel like we're there.
So speaking of the heart and the emotion, now let's get into Art Witch Academy.
Right.
What is Art Witch Academy?
So that's a really wonderful project that I started with two of my fellow art witches. So all three of us were just chatting one day and we all have a different art practice and practice, witchcraft practice. And so we were all saying how, oh, it would be so cool to learn from each other. Because one of my art sisters, my art witch sister, Emily, she works a lot with goddesses, which I rejected for the longest time because it was like, in my
too
mind,
too close to Catholicism, dogma, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But so she, I was like super interested in what she had to say. And then Caroline, she's really interested in symbology and symbols and using those like sigils and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I work with archetypes and the tarot a lot in my art practice. So then we're like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if there was an Art Witch Academy? Caroline said that. And I said, well, now that you said it, we have to do it.
I mean, it's already named. Again, totally. We talked about the power of naming.
I think like 2 days later, we bought the domain. Yes, and then yes. we were like, let's do this. And so we got together, you know, virtually, because they are both in England and I'm in China. Mm-hmm. And
how did you meet? Did you meet online or are they friends of yours from the
Commonwealth? No, we met online. Yeah. Totally online. Yeah, yeah. Through Instagram. Mm-hmm. And then we just like decided to start this project. So it's an actual academy. So we have semesters. We wanted to use trimesters, but then it sounded too much like pregnancy. So yeah. We just, okay, we'll go with semesters. And so it's a running membership. And then when you go, you become a member, you go on the site, we have different rooms like in an academy. So mm-hmm. you have the seminars room where we have lessons. There's the laboratory where we have more out of the art journal sort of lessons. there's her story where we have modern witches and also like art witches, basically. So mm-hmm. we did a thing on Niki de Saint-Phalle mm-hmm. and also Frida Kahlo and her diaries, Florence Welch. So a whole different range.
Yeah.
We also have interviews with art witches that are contemporaries, our friends or people who inspire us. And then we have the broom closet, yeah. which is my favorite because it's shadow work. So we have a section for that.
Can you get into that, please? Because this sure. is something that I feel like doesn't come up as much as the other things that you talked about. So dig right. in.
Shadow work.
Dig me in, wow. archaeologist.
Oh my God, it's going to be so long. So talking about bones, right? And yeah. singing over your bones and really digging deep. So for me, shadow work is so important. And I feel like I'm doing it all the time because I am... My spouse is a diplomat, and so we are posted to a different place. So far, it's been China every 2 to 3 years. And so I constantly have to reinvent myself. But I'm an archaeologist. I really like to have roots, and I really like settling. So it's always been so hard for me to like pick everything up and start again in a place that I haven't chosen and where I cannot work. I like to make roots. I need to make roots. So being unable to do that, I sort of have had to work on that part of me. So most of my tattoos concern that, like reminding myself, don't worry. It's okay to accept change, to let it come and to let it be a part of you. And so I've been doing a lot of shadow work myself.
So for those listeners who have never heard shadow work.
Well, yes.
Yeah. What is, right. like, what even is it?
So basically, like for me, it's addressing the part of you that makes you uncomfortable or that has made you react in a way that has surprised you. So I know I'm very close to my shadow. I know exactly what it is. It has to do with not feeling like not being seen or seen at the wrong time. And I've been working on it for the last 5-6 years easily. And it's not easy because it's very confronting. Mm-hmm. But it feels so good to let the light in to those dark corners. And so I really think it's a worthy exercise. And so in the broom closet, we have like self-contained lessons that are not too long, you know, but that really allow you to start shedding light on that and then to go further with it afterward. I think it's like you gain so much when you do it. Mm-hmm. And like I was like my hand was kind of forced for me the first time because it's when I had to address the fact that now I did